Here it's Wisconsin Today, I'm Rob Ferret. Yesterday, the Trump administration's revival of its travel ban went into effect, blocking citizens from a dozen countries and partially restricting travelers from seven other nations. That includes a ban on foreign nationals from Afghanistan. Since the withdrawal of American troops nearly 4 years ago, roughly 200,000 Afghans have resettled in the U.S. Around that same number, though, are outside the U.S. in various stages of the application process to enter the country. That also comes as the Trump administration ended temporary protected status last month for more than 10,000 Afghan refugees living in the U.S. What does this all mean for Afghan people in Wisconsin and beyond? Najib Azad is an author, lawyer, and faculty member at UW-Madison and an Afghan evacuee who resettled in Stevens Point after the Taliban takeover in August of 2021. Najib, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Good morning, Wisconsin.
You immigrated to the U.S. from Afghanistan after that Taliban takeover back in 2021. As this travel ban comes into effect this week, is this creating uncertainty for people you know, maybe people you know personally, aiming to apply to live in the U.S.?
Well, honestly speaking, yeah, I have been in contact with 100 families since, you know, I work as a press secretary of the former Afghan president, so many Afghans know me pretty well. And being a lawyer, and then I also work as a client navigator at Catholic Multicultural Center, you know, assisting the immigrants. So I have been in contact with many. It has affected many, those Afghans, a couple thousand families, been in third countries for almost 4 years, and their cases have been processed by the U.S. government, multiple agencies, and they are waiting just to fly to the United States. And they are in limbo now. They have no future. So this has affected even those who worked for the U.S. government in Afghanistan, and they fought the U.S. war in Afghanistan for the U.S. interest in international or global values, and they were at risk. They were evacuated by the U.S. forces to third countries. They have been living in U.S. camps for third countries. They have been inspected, investigated, processed, and they had to be here today, but unfortunately, now they are in limbo.
For people in that situation, they'd been through the process, they're waiting for that opportunity to fly to the U.S. What are they doing now? Are they just waiting? Are they looking at going back to Afghanistan, looking at another country to land in? Where are they now?
Well, since they are, most of them, 99% of them are at the U.S. military camps in third countries, like in Middle East and Qatar, or in Germany in Ramstein Air Force Air Base and many others. So they don't have control to where either to go back or to come here, and they will be sent the way they were evacuated. But it will be highest risk if they are sent back to Afghanistan, not only because they work for the U.S. forces in the last two decades, but even after they were evacuated, they are considered U.S. spies by the Taliban. So they, of course, none of them never wants to go back to the country that is ruling by the Taliban, that is ruled by a group that's still considered terrorist by the U.S. So yeah, they are, unfortunately, they are living in anxiety, depression, distress. That's how they are today, and they are told absolutely nothing that what tomorrow brings for them.
You mentioned people who had worked with the U.S. while the U.S. military and civilian forces, for that matter, were in the country. There is this special immigrant visa, or SIV, and the Trump administration said, well, this ban doesn't necessarily apply to that. There's still that exception. However, I understand there are some technicalities that can prevent people from being in that status, even if they worked alongside the U.S. in one way or another. How is that situation working?
Before I answer this question, I would just like to quote something from the U.S. government or the U.S. administration just in 2 weeks. So when the Trump administration ended the TPS status for the Afghans, Secretary Kristi Noem said, I'm quoting her, "We have reviewed the condition in Afghanistan with our interagency partners, and they do not meet the requirement for TPS designation. Afghanistan has had an improved security situation and it is stabilizing economy and no longer prevent these Afghans or those with TPS in here in the United States from returning to their home country. So that was on May 12th. Secretary Christie said Afghanistan is a safe country now. But on June 4th, with this travel ban, White House statement stated, I'm quoting, the Taliban specially designated global terrorist group, SDGT, controls Afghanistan. So now, just 2 weeks before, the Department of Homeland Security said Afghanistan is a safe country and those with TPS status in the United States should return to their country. And on June 4th, travel banning, they said, well, Taliban are global terrorist groups. So contradiction, that's one thing. About the SIV, so those with special immigration visa who work for or on behalf of the U.S. government in Afghanistan for, you know, during those two decades, they are exempted, but now there was an agency that was formed by veterans, U.S. veterans, civil societies in previous administration. That agency called CARE, which was one of the best and safest legal pathway for Afghans to make it to the United States. Now that doesn't exist any longer. It doesn't exist any longer. The SIV, the Afghans, they cannot afford at this point to purchase tickets to fly to the United States to pay for their travels. And this agency does not exist anymore. No resettlement benefits are provided anymore. So even those 90% of SIV status holders or those are waiting with special immigration visas cannot make it to the U.S. because flying from Afghanistan to the United States costs about $15,000 to $2,000 per person, and a family of 10 does not have $2,000 at this point. Those who have been in military camps with no working, with no economy, I mean, with no money. So even the SIV, technically not affected by travel ban, but indirectly providing no logistics or no resettlement benefits or travel benefits, they are also affected, unfortunately. They can't make it at this point with the situation they are living in.
Talking to Najib Azad, he is an Afghan evacuee now working at UW-Madison, looking at changes in Trump administration immigration policy. Najib, are there people here in Wisconsin from Afghanistan who are affected by these various changes, the travel ban, the end of temporary protected status, and throw in cuts to refugee services in the U.S.? What does this mean for people from Afghanistan already here in the state?
Well, there are many here in Wisconsin, Minnesota, I mean, in mid-state, the people that I've been in contact with, the TPS status and affected by travel ban, the worst part is that they have also filed asylum. They have submitted the applications long ago, but unfortunately, you know, USCIS and particularly in Milwaukee, is pretty slow processing their cases. And then they don't have TPS any longer, so their work authorization is not renewed. And then if their work authorization is not renewed, their employers send them home, and then they cannot work. If they cannot work, they, you know, like how would they feed their kids? So there are many other challenges because of this executive order for them. Many that I personally know here in Madison and the Twin City and Winona, Minnesota, they have had TPS, which does not exist anymore. Their asylum or refugee status is still pending, and their employment authorization documentation are not renewed because TPS did not exist, which that they cannot legally work. That is another biggest challenge. So they are also facing the trauma, anxiety, distress. That's how these executive orders affected those who work for the U.S. government for 20 years.
In our last minute or so, the argument from the Trump administration on this whole list of countries, including Afghanistan, is, hey, there's not enough documentation in the home country. We can't responsibly vet people who want to come into the U.S. from these countries. What do you say that in regards to Afghanistan?
Well, in regards to Afghanistan, like I said before, 90% of those who work for the U.S. government, for the U.S. military, they were evacuated years ago. They have been living in U.S. military bases for more than three years. They were processed. They were inspected. They were interviewed. And the documentation they had in hand were from the previous Afghan regime or government in cooperation with the U.S. System. And then, the most importantly, those who work for the U.S. government, the U.S. government has their records. The military of the United States has their records, their biometrics, their all documentation. The person who worked in Afghanistan 20 years ago, the United States government has their records in their system. So they were all processed. And after the confirmation, satisfaction, they were then sent to third countries to be processed to the U.S. So I don't see any logic, any rationality in this argument. And then just like I brought to you two different statements from the U.S. government in 2 weeks, which is 360 degree contradictory with the other one. That argument is the same thing. You know, it's contradiction with what's on the ground, you know, the ground reality, which is that the U.S. government has a system that has that has records for every single Afghan who served the U.S. in Afghanistan in the last 20 years.
Najib, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
You're very welcome. You have a nice day.
That's Najib Azad, author, lawyer, and faculty member at UW-Madison. Azad is an Afghan evacuee who resettled in Stevens Point after the Taliban takeover in August 2021. We've been talking about the impact of a travel ban and other Trump administration moves when it comes to Afghan evacuees here in Wisconsin. Coming up on Wisconsin Today, a proposed bill in the state legislature aims to bring women more info about menopause and perimenopause.
I think it's important to remember and realize that half of the population is going to experience this at some point, and that this is, you know, a natural process that happens just like puberty.
Advice from UW medical expert coming up next. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret. A bipartisan bill circulating in the state capitol would require more education on menopause from local healthcare providers. In a statement, lawmakers say menopause and perimenopause are, quote, often misunderstood and too often neglected or ignored. They also highlighted testimony from women about the difficulty in being heard and taken seriously discussing menopause and the issues that surround it. Here's Margie from Milwaukee describing her symptoms from a WPR program back in 2023.
When I was working, I'm retired now, I was being diagnosed in my early 50s with ADD, the inattentive type. And I know it was compounded during menopause, and I did end up losing a job because of my difficulty being able to focus and stay organized. It was extremely difficult time.
The proposed bill would call on the State Department of Health Services to create informational materials in partnership with local health care providers to inform patients and reduce stigma. So what should women know about menopause and this midlife transition? And what misconceptions are out there? Dr. Laura Bizzuto is the leader of UW Health's Menopause Clinic. She's an OBGYN and breast surgical oncologist and an assistant professor at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. Dr. Bizzuto, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thanks for having me.
I want to start with this notion in the state legislature of giving more information to women when they see their health care providers about menopause, about perimenopause. From your perspective, what kind of information would be most useful in those situations?
Yeah, I think this is great to emphasize educating women and having options available for them to learn more about menopause and perimenopause. The most important thing is, you know, high quality evidence that's based in science that not only tells people what's happening, but what will happen with their health as they go through this transition.
There's, in some cases, maybe not enough information that women are encountering, but also there's a lot of, I understand, misinformation out there that you're worried about. What are some of the sources, what are some of the concerns you have of bad information out there?
Yeah, this has unfortunately just been an area that hasn't been as well educated about in medicine, and there's just been a dearth of information and for women and for, you know, educating physicians, unfortunately, until recently. And so whenever there's the gaps in available information and resources, unfortunately, a lot of misinformation comes up. And with the internet and how quickly things spread on the internet now, unfortunately, a lot of misinformation about supplements that maybe don't have very good information or data about them and other kind of things that don't have good evidence that they work for these symptoms. They're looking for anything, so they'll find something out there on the internet that might not be as helpful as we hope.
I've heard that concern you mentioned before that healthcare providers, physicians, and others weren't getting enough training in issues related to perimenopause and menopause. Do you see that changing?
Yeah, I think so. So there were some major studies that were done on menopause and hormone therapy in the past that unfortunately didn't have great results, and so resulted in a lot of healthcare and health education and physicians kind of swinging away from looking at menopause, looking at treatments for menopausal symptoms for a long time. But now I think with this new emphasis on this transition that all women go through and the health effects that it has, I think there's a renewed interest in educating not just women, but also providers on how they can, you know, how this affects their patients and how we can help.
Can you lay out for us a little menopause 101, please? What is happening at this basically inevitable transition?
Right. So the ovaries, as they age, are just less and less efficient at doing their job, making eggs for fertilization and making hormones, including estrogen and progesterone. And so as the fertility declines, and that coincides with a decline in estrogen, which is the main hormone that causes the symptoms of menopause. So menopause is once the ovaries stop working and no longer ovulate eggs, and women haven't had a period for 12 months. That is the definition of menopause. So it's kind of a retrospective diagnosis. We can only know when someone's had their last menstrual period, once it's already happened and 12 months have gone by. But perimenopause is used to describe the time preceding that, when many women will experience some fluctuations in hormones as the ovaries are just becoming less efficient at their job.
And that can come with symptoms, manifestations of these changes going on. It can be very different, right, from person to person. But what are some of the most common symptoms, side effects that women might experience?
Absolutely. So the average age of menopause in the U.S. is 51 and a half years old. But there's a range of normal times that people can go through menopause. Really anywhere between 45 and 55 can be normal. And many people can experience some of these perimenopausal symptoms even well before they have their last period, even, you know, in their 40s. Most common symptoms that people experience are some changes in their menstrual bleeding patterns. And so some people's periods might get closer together before they eventually become less frequent. Hot flashes are very common. Some sleep disturbances, night sweats, which interrupt sleep, are very common. Even some changes in mood, increased risks of depression, anxiety, irritability can occur. Those are all common symptoms that people can experience.
Now, these are common symptoms, and they can vary in intensity. Are these things that people just have to live with, right? You have hot flashes, which can be debilitating for some people for periods of time. Is there treatment out there? And we'll dig into specific treatments, but do people have to accept that this is just the way it is, or are there options out there?
There are definitely options, and I'm happy to be able to say that we do have some good options, both for people who are interested in hormonal treatments and for people who aren't. For people who can't have hormonal treatments. It's definitely not something you have to suffer in silence, and seeking out medical care should be on people's radar. One of the best ways to find a provider who is well-versed in menopause care, the Menopause Society is our kind of medical organization that studies and takes care of menopause. And they have a online directory of certified menopause providers. So that's a really great way to find a physician or a nurse practitioner or PA who is well-versed in managing menopause.
We're talking with the leader of UW Health's Menopause Clinic, Dr. Laura Bizzuto. State lawmakers have drafted legislation that would require healthcare providers to give out more info on menopause and the time leading up to it. Dr. Bizzuto, let's start digging into treatment. Now, you mentioned a hormone treatment. Now, I remember a couple decades ago, one of the biggest health stories was, okay, we'd been using more and more HRT, hormone replacement therapy, for menopause. Then studies came out saying, hey, we're worried about maybe increased risk of cancer and certain heart conditions, things like that. And then some like backlash to the backlash saying, well, maybe it's about the timing. Where are we now in how we use hormone replacement therapy for menopause?
Yeah, that's a great question. And that's actually a really good summary of where we've been and where we are now. I would say currently we have much better understanding of the risks that are associated with different times of use of hormone therapy, I would say. And so we have kind of better understanding that for women who go through early menopause, so menopause that's less than age 45, there really are significant health benefits to hormones that can help mitigate a lot of the health concerns that can happen. And then for people who go through menopause at a normal age, hormones can really help with a lot of the symptoms and have, for most women, have fairly minimal risks.
So when a patient is presenting with some of the more extreme manifestations of menopause, those debilitating hot flashes and night sweats, for example, what kind of process do you go through to figure out if hormone replacement therapy is the right answer?
One of the first things is just talking with women and making sure these symptoms really are due to menopause and not, I think sometimes as women, we want to attribute all of our symptoms to hormone changes and menopausal changes, but we want to make sure that really there's not an underlying health condition that's causing some of these similar symptoms. So seeing a doctor and being evaluated is important. And then a good health history, thinking about other health issues, family history, cancer risks, before we kind of think about what treatments might be best.
Then, and I hadn't known about this, there's a non-hormonal therapy. FDA approved it in 2023. Fezolinetant, if I'm saying that right. Can you tell us a little bit about this non-hormonal therapy?
Yeah. This is a newer medication, as you mentioned, that works on the neurons in the brain that are affected by the changes in estrogen that occur with menopause and are basically the causal area of the hot flashes, cyclical hot flashes that people get with menopause. It's really great because researchers have found kind of the cause of these symptoms and a non-hormonal treatment that is very effective. So for most women who start this medication, they have really significant improvement in symptoms, even in just 2 weeks.
Is this a case where this newer medicine is turning into, you know, plan A, the first thing we try? Or if not, how are we balancing that versus those older hormonal medications?
for many women, we think about both hormonal and non-hormonal options, and it really just becomes a assessment of what might achieve the best results for an individual and their own priorities. There are certainly women who for whom hormones are not recommended. Someone who has a history of a blood clot or bleeding problem, they may not be a great option for. And so, or a history of cancer. And so these non-hormonal options really open the door for women who can't have hormonal treatments to still get good symptom relief.
Now, for people dealing with the side effects of menopause, are there lifestyle things they can do, maybe instead of medication if it's not too severe, or alongside medication that will help at least with some of the symptom relief?
Absolutely. So a lot of the lifestyle changes have not great evidence that they actually help with the hot flashes or frequency that people get hot flashes, but they certainly may help with how bothered individuals are by them. So wearing layers, fans, weight loss has been shown to maybe improve some symptoms of hot flashes and things. The best evidence for non-medication options actually is cognitive behavioral therapy, which does have good evidence that it can help improve hot flashes and the bothersomeness that people experience from them.
Now, you mentioned making sure that, hey, this symptom is, in fact, from menopause and ruling out maybe some other underlying condition. Are there more serious health or medical conditions that might come along with menopause for some women, some complications, I guess, that you watch for?
Yeah. One of the first things that we think about is making sure any abnormal vaginal bleeding isn't from a cause that's, related to cancer or another issue that we need to address and that is important to rule out. Other things we think about are thyroid disorders, which can be common in women around the same age, joint pain and other causes of pain or insomnia are important to rule out. Weight changes can be related to thyroid or other underlying disorders that we want to make sure. Rarely cancers can have hot flashes, weight changes, and sleep changes, but that's luckily, relatively uncommon.
And yeah, part of your the many hats you wear, you're a surgical oncologist, and I wanted to ask, does the cancer risk profile of a woman change as they go through perimenopause and menopause?
Yeah, so breast cancer is the most common cancer that we see in this kind of age range of people, although colon cancer is becoming more and more common for women in their 40s. The other thing that we think about is the hormonal changes that come with hormone therapy can increase breast density, which can make mammograms somewhat more difficult to interpret, and prolonged use of estrogen and progesterone hormone therapy may be associated with a small increased risk of breast cancer.
Looking to the future, you mentioned you see improvements in the way healthcare providers are educated about menopause. How about the research landscape? Is this something that you've seen as maybe under-researched in the past? How are we doing on it now?
Yeah, it's definitely something that is getting more attention. And I think, as we see with this new medication that was approved just a few years ago, there is more interest in research in this area. I think that there are going to be other medications in the same class that are being developed currently and some other interesting targeted treatments for vaginal symptoms and others as well.
And bringing things back to this bill circulating in the state legislature, the statement on it says menopause can be associated with stigma. How can we reduce the stigma around this, really perfectly natural life transition and make sure people are talking about it?
Right. I think it's important to remember and realize that half of the population is going to experience this at some point, and that this is, a natural process that happens just like puberty. But there's no fourth grade health class for menopause, other than coming to your doctor with questions. So, and hopefully having more educational materials available.
Dr. Bizzuto, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Dr. Laura Bizzuto. She leads the menopause clinic at UW Health. She's an OBGYN and surgical oncologist, and she's an assistant professor in the departments of obstetrics and gynecology and surgery at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. When talking about the latest news on menopause treatment and education, that after lawmakers drafted a bill that would require more education for women at healthcare facilities about menopause and perimenopause. According to Axios, Wisconsin is not the only state considering this kind of legislation. More than 20 bills focused on menopause care have been introduced across at least 13 states just so far this year. And we want to hear from you. What was your experience like when entering menopause and that perimenopause stage? What information was out there that you found helpful? What misinformation did you come across? And what do you wish had been out there for you? And do you think this proposed legislation is going to be enough to help reduce stigma and inform the public? Email us. Let us know. Share your story if you're willing. The email is wisconsintoday@wpr.org. That's wisconsintoday@wpr.org. And you can .org. And you can find more coverage on issues at the state capitol. Visit wpr.org for coverage from our news team here at Wisconsin Public Radio. Still ahead, Sun Prairie's Mural Fest is a tribute to their native daughter, Georgia O'Keeffe, a pioneer of American modern art. The artist organizing the murals tells us about O'Keeffe's influence.
Following her own road, writing her own story, is why she's so important, not just to Sun Prairie, where she's from, but to just anywhere.
That's next on Wisconsin Today. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret. Sun Prairie is honoring its most famous daughter with a massive mural project on the Washington Mills factory building in its downtown. Mural Fest kicks off later this month as artists from around the country gather to paint portions of a mural to honor the legacy of Georgia O'Keeffe. Born in 1887, O'Keeffe was known as the mother of American modernism. She was a pioneer of modern art and one of the most famous and influential artists of her time. But before all of that, she spent her childhood growing up on a farm near Sun Prairie. Wisconsin muralist Lena Ugrin is lead organizer for the Sun Prairie Mural Fest. She talked to Kate Archer-Kent.
Lena, Mural Fest is going to be a celebration of Georgia O'Keeffe's legacy. What is her legacy like to you?
For me, Georgia O'Keeffe represents a voice of fearless, mess and power and owning your own spirit, your own voice in the times when, you know, it was hard for artists that are women to be successful and to pursue their dreams. And she just owned her own work. She was true to herself. She was true to her art. She just followed her curiosity without being influenced by any major movement. She was a pioneer. She just didn't care what anybody thought. And for me, that uniqueness, that following of her own road, writing her own story, is why she's so important, not just to Sun Prairie, where she's from, but to just anywhere, to America.
Can you take us to this mural space? How did you find the Washington Mills factory, and what is it like?
Yes. So this is, if you can imagine, a giant factory building that has never been actually painted at all. And it's just this gray block wall that's just been staring back at me for a year. And I just was constantly contemplating what could be living on it. You know, it's just, as a muralist, you always see walls, and it's like kind of like every time I drive anywhere, I'm kind of looking at walls and what's out there. And this wall, I've been just like looking at it for so long. And then finally, I got connected with Lou, the plant manager. And he and another person from Washington Mills, we had a meeting, and I presented them with the idea of the mural fest on their wall. And I am a muralist myself, so I do go to paint jams and mural festivals. And I really, really love the idea of being among your peers, because as an artist, you work a lot alone. And it's not like you're going into the office and you have a bunch of peers with you, and you're most of the time alone. And then just these festivals bring all your peers together, and we just get to create together. We get to connect to the community. People come say hi, come talk to us. And I just thought, like, this could be a really cool gallery wall in downtown Sun Prairie. And I've noticed that there wasn't much murals happening in Sun Prairie at all. So I presented the idea. They were very interested, and they said, we're down. Let us know, you know, how we can help. From there, I was like, well, I have a wall. Now what? Yep. So I was like, okay, so that's one thing. So now I have to figure out how to make it all happen. And then I got connected with bid manager Mary, and then presented the idea to her. And she was like, yeah, I love that. Let's see, you know, let's see if it's doable. Let's see what permits we need. Then she brought in Barbara, the tourism director, and three of us just started planning and strategizing and figuring out everything, you know.
That is so wonderful. And in the end, there are 9 artists, including yourself, participating in the mural. How did you decide on who to pick for the project?
Yes. So we had an open call sometime, I believe, like, in beginning of the March or so. And 118 artists applied from all over the country, which was really cool to see. We even had a couple of DMs from international artists asking about it. But this year we decided to stick with keep it on the Wisconsin and national line, just because it's first time doing this, and we didn't really know if we would need to deal with visas or anything. So we realized it's easier for the first year to do it more locally. Mm-hmm. So we decided that we're going to have 50% of artists being from Wisconsin, and then the rest can be from anywhere in America. And that's the United States. And then we had the open call, artists applied. Then we had a jury of 6 local professionals. All of them are either artists or have some sort of art background to them, or they're local business owners. And so that's we had 6 people going through 2 levels of choosing. First one was like a blind online voting, where I took all the applications and put together the pictures of each artist on one slide. And I excluded everything that I could, the name and everything. Mm. So they only can see the art and vote on the art. And that gave us that first voting session, gave us like sort of a leaderboard, if you will.
Yeah, sure, sure. Well, we know how Georgia O'Keeffe was so influenced by the desert and by Ghost Ranch, and that Southwestern look. But I wonder, will there be Wisconsin influences that we see go up on this wall?
I believe it will, yes. I think that the interpretations are more abstract in a way, not in a theme sense, but in a inspiration. When I set out the artist call, I still wanted it. I wanted to honor Georgia by also honoring contemporary artists and their voices, because that's what she did. She followed her voice. So we wanted the artists who are inspired by Georgia, but not necessarily always has to be by, you know, her work looks like, but more on, you know, you could be inspired by her life or a portion of part of her work or something. So we have a good variety of artworks that I think people will enjoy. Some of them are, some artworks will be more like, you could see the visual connection to Georgia, and others, it's more in a story behind the mural, which is really cool.
We're talking about a downtown Sun Prairie mural, a building in Sun Prairie about to be transformed, influenced by the Wisconsin native Georgia O'Keeffe. Lena Ugren is with us, a muralist from Wisconsin and Mural Fest lead organizer. Lena, how physically demanding is creating a mural and this art form?
It is very demanding. It is physical labor in connection with art. It's a lot of the time people don't realize that while we are providing, muralists are providing you with design portion, we also come out and do the painting, which requires a lot of the time usage of heavy like machinery, like lifts or scaffolding, putting the scaffolding up and down, going up and down the ladders, holding long poles with brushes on the end. So it's very, very physical. And for me, in particular, I usually don't feel it while I'm doing it. It comes the day after. Like your full body's like, what did you do?
But in this instance, you're going to be surrounded by artists who are all doing this and pitching in. And I wonder if that camaraderie will be helpful.
Yes, it always is. It's just, it will be helpful on, you know, us inspiring each other, just having, you know, if, you know, for example, if I'm alone working on a mural and I'm up on the lift and I forgot something down, because it happens, you know, I have to get all the way down and all that from scaffolding or lift to get it. This way, when you have friends and buddies around you, they can just, you know, hand you stuff and, you know, you can help each other in that little ways that, you know, save you some time and stuff. And also, I've seen people, you know, helping each other finish their pieces when somebody's slower than others. I've seen people, you know, just filming each other, cheering each other on. It's just really beautiful to see artists work together.
How colorful will these 9 murals be?
Very colorful. I think people will enjoy it. And each mural has its own sort of like theme and story and a different color palette. So it's definitely going to be like 9 different people painted them. And it's going to look like a gallery wall. And we are getting paint from Holman Lindsay. There are paint and artist sponsor, which is really sweet. And so most of the murals will be painted in that. And we have a couple of spray paint artists who are using spray paint as well.
You know, I would imagine that every blank wall you see is a blank canvas to you. It is something to fill with art. And I'm curious, do you think this will be the start of more murals in Sun Prairie?
I think it will, Sun Prairie and beyond. I think projects like this trigger and inspire other projects, and people sometimes forget about what art does for them until they have it. And I think when they have it here and start enjoying it, they will actually, you know, it will invoke something in them, more inspiration, more wanting of art, to be surrounded by art in their community and in their personal space as well.
I'd like to ask you a personal question about your art, if I could. You being originally from Bosnia and Herzegovina and now at home in Wisconsin, did the Bosnian War in the 90s affect your art?
I believe so. I believe that everything we live through as an artist and every aspect of our life influences our creative processes one way or another. Sometimes it's not the subject matter. Sometimes it's just the way we create and why we create. So I believe strongly that that influenced my art, as well as living now here in a capitalist America. It's just a different, two different countries who kind of like are building me as a human in a way.
Lena, do you get inspiration from places in Wisconsin for your art, for your murals?
I love traveling. I am a little bit addicted to it, I must say. So yes, I definitely get inspired anywhere I go. I get inspired by colors, by shapes, by just like learning and exploring new places, new cultures. Everything literally about going and exploring inspires me. So yes, definitely.
One thing I'm curious about when I see a muralist out working, I'm wondering what happens when it rains as the mural is going on. Like how often you have to check the weather forecast and or what do you do if it rains?
We often check weather forecast as muralists, at least I can say for myself, and I believe all the others do. Yes, it's tricksy, but I just monitor it, and then I just like have, if I know that the downpour is gonna happen, then I just have everything sort of ready to pack real quick, and then I just do something else and come back when the rain stops. And you just, you know, you just, if the rain's going to take the whole day, then you just don't paint that day. But if it's going to be on and off, I had a project in Tennessee the other week, and it was raining on and off nonstop. So I literally had these glimpses of time of like an hour, and I would go in and paint for an hour. Then I would go back to my car and like do some doodling on my iPad for another project. Then I would go back and dry my piece and paint again. So it depends on how heavy the rain is. If it's super heavy, then you probably wouldn't want to paint. But if it's like, you know, light rain, you can just get right back to it.
Well, Lena, I wish you nothing but sunny skies in the 8 or 9 days that all the muralists will be together and working so hard. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Lena Ugrin is a Wisconsin muralist and lead organizer of the Sun Prairie Mural Fest project. She talked to Kate Archer Kent. The grand revealing of the finished murals in honor of Georgia O'Keeffe will take place on Thursday, June 26th, with additional special events happening throughout that weekend. Tomorrow on the show, we'll hear a conversation with a family who run an orchard together here in Wisconsin. They say one of the best parts of it is that it brings them together as a family.
The best times we have together, kid you not, that's how children say, the best time we have together is when we work together.
Do you have a memorable experience working together with other family members, whether that's on a farm or other family business, maybe just a big project you did with a parent, a child, or a sibling? We'd love to share your story in a future program. Email us at wisconsintoday@wpr.org, or you can call or text to get in touch at 888-642-0232. That's 888-642-0232. Wisconsin Today producers include Trevor Hook, Mackenzie Crummy, and Royce Podeswa. Our technical directors are Tyler Ditter and Sarah Hopeful. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to WPR News.